Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is simply unpopular. In fact, the only country that supports it is Israel. What was supposed to be a walk in the park is now a protracted and dangerous conflict with global implications. And time is on Iran's side. Cross-talking Trump's war, I'm joined by my guest David Swanson in Charlottesville. He is an author and the executive director of worldbeyondwar.org. In Reston, we have Michael Maloof. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. And in Beirut, we cross to Ali Risk. He is a security and political affairs analyst. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. David, let me go to you first here. Going into the third week of this war, we still don't know why. What was the predicate? We don't really know what the goal is. We know what Israel's is. Israel wants a forever war. But the Trump administration hasn't been able to articulate really what it's doing. I want to talk about the crucible called the Strait of Hormuz a little bit later. But I would contend, David, that using common sense fails us all because there's no common sense in any of this. David.
Well, trying to figure out what's in Trump's brain is a hopeless pursuit. I think his notion that China might help him out suggests that he believes he's running the entire world. He's not, you know, one portion of it. But I think the fact that he didn't really bother to try to lie us into this is part of why it's so unpopular. Unfortunately, there are people in the United States who will fall for the lies if they put a little bit of effort and creativity into it, and they just didn't. But at the same time, that is very, very unpopular, even in the United States, even after having started the war, which is unprecedented. You do have the problem that at least half of this country believes the Democratic Party is doing everything it can to stop the war. And they're really not. When you have an unpopular war, their strategy is typically to keep it going in order to be against it, quote unquote, against it, to oppose it in the next election. And so they were very careful to avoid a war powers vote until the war could get started. They didn't whip the votes on it. And their objection is not that anybody's been killed, that any schools have been blown up, that the rule of law has been shattered. Their objection is it wasn't properly authorized. You didn't have a proper plan. You didn't have an exit strategy. You didn't have proper, appropriate goals to win the war. And, you know, it's this sort of procedural nonsense. And unfortunately, people do fall for that. They believe there's this grand struggle going on in the United States Congress where, you know, just about everybody is paid for by the weapons companies.
Yeah, and AIPAC is a very powerful force in the U.S. Congress as well. You know, Michael, we're really seeing the United States and Israel on one side and the Iranians on the other side just speaking at cross purposes. I mean, the foreign minister recently said that nothing is on the table, but Donald Trump says that they want to negotiate. I mean, we always accept there's a fog of war here, but the more the foreign minister of Iran appears on CBS News, he seems like the adult in the room. Michael.
Well, he's been burned twice. Each time he tried to negotiate, Trump attacked Iran. First in June, and now again. So I think he's learned his lesson about trying to negotiate with the president. And even if he could work out an agreement, Trump has shown through history, and so have the other leaders, previous presidents, that they can't keep agreements. So I don't see how any country in the world would ever want to enter into an agreement with the United States at this juncture, because we don't keep our agreements. We just don't. So, consequently, I think we've done a great job of isolating ourselves along with the Israelis in the world today. Iran and the United States, to be honest with you, are fighting two different kinds of wars.
Yes.
We're going in with shock and awe and all that and thinking that air power is going to rule the day. The Iranians have, through different culture and thinking, have come up with something entirely different, more unconventional, if you will. They know they cannot compete with the type of air power that and Navy that the United States has. So they've come up with alternative means. And the United States, doesn't know how to deal with it. And that's why they're still able, despite all the bombings, to continue lobbing missiles and drones. They have an entirely different strategy, and the U.S. approach has not conformed to that yet or been able to deal with it. That's what you do. You come up with an alternative.
Yeah, Ali, because it's an existential war for the Iranians, and it's the Americans primarily that don't understand that. It's to be or not to be. And on top of it, the U.S. appears to have one strategy, if you can call it a strategy at all. But the Israelis certainly do. They want a forever war. They want the United States to be in a protracted war against Iran for a very long time. That suits their purposes, Ali.
Yeah, before I answer, just quickly regarding what Michael was just saying, I think what you're saying is remarkable and perhaps unprecedented. You have a country which is launching guerrilla warfare. Now, guerrilla warfare is usually carried out by non-state actors. I think for the first time you see a country carrying out guerrilla warfare where it's transforming these apparent weaknesses into strengths, targeting American bases, targeting the oil. It's something I think which we haven't seen, at least in modern day times. Regarding your question about the Americans not having a strategy, indeed, it's the Israelis who have a strategy. And I have to say, it appears that the Israeli strategy until now has succeeded. In other words, they've succeeded in dragging Trump this far. And I wouldn't be surprised if they succeed in dragging Trump even further into this quagmire. Netanyahu, he wants the Americans to place boots on the ground. I think he wants to have any scenario whatsoever which would either lead to regime change in Iran or would lead to a weak state in Iran, both of which the Israelis would favor. And so I do think that indeed Netanyahu, again, he has succeeded, and he still appears to be succeeding in dragging Trump this far. And it's all coming at the expense, I believe, of American interests. So I think you have a tug of war taking place. Now, on the one hand, Israel is lobbying Trump to go even further, playing to his ego by saying that you have the opportunity to be the first American president who destroys an enemy of the US, being Iran, and Israel is being helped in that regard by Lindsey Graham and other war hawks in Washington. Iran is trying to pull him in the other direction by making him pay the economic costs and the cost in terms of his own popularity. So it depends on who's able to sway Trump further in their own direction.
You know, David, going into the third week of the war, we always talk about, it's always the adversary. You want to give them an off-ramp, okay? But actually, it's Trump that needs an off-ramp. But I would say we're past that point, given what we just heard from Ali. Go ahead, David.
Well, given the general nonsensical nature of Trump, he can take an off-ramp at any time. He can simply stop the war, whether he will or not, whether he answers to Israel or who he answers to is not entirely clear. But it's gone full circle now from, I would argue, another war where a country was using guerrilla warfare, Vietnam, where the United States would exaggerate the casualty figures, to the intervening decades where we had to pretend to minimize the casualty figures, back now to where they brag every day about who's been killed and how many have been killed. And you now have millions displaced and many, many thousands injured. And so the notion of the off-ramp being some sort of successful gaining of the support of the Iranian people is just completely out the window, as it has been for 50 years and 60 years in some other countries, of these counterproductive sanctions that they pretend are to gain support and overthrow a government. But if you start getting more lives that matter lost, that's going to be the end of it for Trump. I mean, this is why the Europeans are, use your bases in our country, but not troops. We won't send troops, because some lives matter. Some deaths matter. They couldn't possibly care less about the people of Iran or the people of Lebanon. But U.S. lives, European lives. This is what matters to them. And I search for casualties in the war on Iran, and I come up with 7 or 11 or 15, you know, while thousands have been killed, right? It's because that's what matters. And so if you get some more of those, either you're going to get that we must kill more in honor of those already killed, yeah, which they usually try. But I don't think that's going to work here. I think it's going to be we have to get out.
You know, Michael, is boots on the ground, that's still on the table, according to the Trump administration. Is that a bluff at this point, or is it real?
No, I think when you bring in the expeditionary force of Marines all the way from Far East, that suggests to me that they intend to at least try to occupy Karg Island. And I'm really worried about that. And of course, all of this is being done without any congressional oversight or approval. And so the possibility is there. Once you introduce those troops, this war can escalate. It's easier to start a war than it is to end one. And I think that this is probably what we're going to be seeing. But if he puts boots on the ground, it's all over for Trump.
Michael, you know your history. I mean, this would be like Gallipoli.
Oh yeah. This is actually a mirror image in some respects to what happened in 2003 with Bush invasion of Iraq. What we're seeing here is trying to placate Israel and Netanyahu. You have here this game plan that they had. I knew when I was at the Pentagon, I knew about the game plan was to go into Baghdad, use that as a hub for regime change in Damascus, in Tehran, Libya at the time, and then Saudi Arabia. This was all to placate Israel. And now it's gotten even worse because Trump relies upon...
Michael, I got to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on the war on Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the war on Iran. Okay, let's go back to Ali in Beirut. Ali, in the last news cycle, Trump argued that the U.S. has been abandoned by its allies, but allies are dying to help, but the U.S. doesn't need anyone. He said that all in one speech. What do you take away from that?
Before I answer that, just a quick comment about what David said about the Vietnam launching guerrilla warfare. That's true. But this is the first time you're seeing a state launch guerrilla warfare in a transnational way.
Good point.
Vietnam theater of operations was actually in Vietnam. What you're seeing now is the theater of operations is in the broader Persian Gulf region, economic installations, Strait of Hormuz. So it's a different kind, a much more expanded kind of a guerrilla warfare, which Iran is resorting to. About Trump and what he said, I think this reflects the fact that Trump is in a state of loss. He doesn't know exactly how to get out of this mess, which he himself has caused for himself. He allowed himself to be dragged into it by Netanyahu and by the pro-war club in Washington. And so you see these contradictory statements. At times, it appears that he's begging for help from the allies in order to assist in the Strait of Hormuz. And other times, he said he doesn't need them. Now, of course, he does need the allies in the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is leading to a high spike in oil prices. We have an election year this year in the United States. This is going to cost him dearly if the situation continues as it is. Now, a major question is this. If the allies insist on not helping him in the Strait of Hormuz, will he decide to take it alone, which will lead to more escalation? Or could this be, as I think the Iranians want it, could it lead him to retreat and say, enough is enough, I want to end this war, it's becoming too costly? Now, I think that the Iranian bet is the second option, that because he's not going to have any allies at his side, he's going to say, okay, enough is enough, I'll bring this to an end. Iran would reopen the Strait of Hormuz. But that would be met with great resistance by Israel and by the pro-Israeli lobby. Yep. And they're going to keep talking to Trump's ego that you look like a weakling, etc. You're another version of Obama. Don't do this. Yep. Let's wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah, gentlemen, it's all about hubris, isn't it? You know, we like to apply geopolitics and history and all this, but no, it gets down to hubris here. David, we're talking about what Trump might do, could do, but we always have to keep in mind that Iran has a veto and so does Israel. That makes Trump's problem even greater. David.
Well, the U.S. public and the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court ought to have a veto.
Sure.
Everything ought not to be in the hands of a single lunatic, but it is. And the U.S. Congress has completely accepted that. And we have these big rallies where we shout no king, but we have a government that behaves as court jesters and courtesans and ensures that we have a king. If there were benevolent aliens coming to Earth and trying to talk us out of our fossil fuel addiction, and they understood that we couldn't be reasoned with, one of the first things they might do would be to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. So I have, mixed emotions about this. But if you shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and then you react by finding more evil black goop elsewhere, or by escalating a war and blowing up ships in the Strait of Hormuz, then, not so benevolent. And this is what we risk, and we shouldn't be risking it. Trump should be removed from office immediately. And if a single U.S. Congress member wanted to uphold their oath to support the U.S. Constitution in any way, Trump would be back in the swamp he came out of by tomorrow.
Yeah, Michael, is the Strait of Hormuz a crucible of this whole war? Because
it's one of them. I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop. The Strait of Hormuz is going to probably remain closed for quite some time. We've already begun to see the effects, but I'm also waiting for the Yemenis to close down Bab al-Mandab Strait, which is another choke point going into the Red Sea. If both of those are shut down, it's going to be catastrophic. It's going to be an overnight world depression, economic depression. And this is going to be, and it's all going to be at Donald Trump's feet. You got to keep in mind that Trump has allegiance not only to Netanyahu, but he also has it to his Jewish contributors. He made major concessions to Marion Adelman and Adelson, and who gave him tens of millions of dollars in contributions, not to mention what the defense industry wants has in mind. But in order to keep a defense industry up, you got to have forever wars, and that's what he's doing. And as we chatted about briefly beforehand, he's already threatening Cuba now. When does it stop? And so. But I think this could become his Achilles heel. And those bases have served as just that, surrounding Iran as his Achilles heel. They were meant to be there for deterrence. They have turned out to be something entirely different. And now they're just prime targets. And if Yemen, which has shown resilience against U.S. air power, is able to shut down the straits of Bab al-Mandab, I think we're really in for a lot of problems in the very, very near future.
Yeah, we have to keep in mind, everyone, there's also the assault on freedom of speech and the media in the United States by this administration. Ali, there's no going back to the status quo ante. Okay? And what I mean by that is that Iran is going to have a say in how this ends. What could they possibly want? Basic demands.
Quickly about Bab al-Mandab regarding the Houthis and what they could do. I think that's being kept to see what the Persian Gulf Arab countries would do.
Yeah.
In other words, should the Persian Gulf Arab country intervene against Iran, then I think you would see the Houthi card come into play. That's why I think it's being kept as a reserve or a precautionary measure to be activated when the appropriate time comes.
Ali, since you bring up a really good point there, let's keep going with it. Why haven't the Gulf countries entered the war against Iran?
Well, look, already you're seeing the damage which has been done to the Gulf countries, whilst they're not actually belligerents in this war. Iran was able to inflict significant damage, and I think that should they become active participants in the war, that would mean even more damage to these Gulf countries. And the American bases have only been able to do so much in terms of protecting these countries. So that would be a very, very risky thing to do if they were indeed to become members or active participants. That's why I think it would be rather far-fetched for these countries to actually intervene or become active participant players.
Yeah, because, Ali, the United States was supposed to protect them. They were not supposed to be put into a situation like this, right?
Indeed, that was the arrangement. But the bases, as I said, have only proven to be able to do so much against the Iranian firepower, which, by the way, has proven to be quite effective in penetrating American defenses, in penetrating even Israeli defenses. So you have a very, very important, I think, transformation which is taking place in terms of the way war is conducted, in terms of the vulnerability as well of American bases.
Okay, and then going back to my original question, the basic demands that Iran would want, like sanction relief, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Regarding the basic demands, we heard a senior Iranian figure, Mohsin Rezai, who said that one of the demands would be for American forces to leave the region.
Right.
Effectively meaning closing American bases. Now, is that only a negotiating tactic? Is it only one figure? Because Rezai is known to be, he's labeled as more of a hardline Iranian figure. Does that indeed represent the Iranian stance, or is this a negotiating tactic, or perhaps one of the point of views being expressed? We have to see how it plays out, but I would assume that at the very least, the Iranians would request real guarantees that they not be subject to a new aggression. Now, how do you provide those kind of guarantees if you don't withdraw them from the region? What kind of arrangements could be made? Could there be a congressional treaty, for example, which would basically make it illegal, American domestic...
Just move them out. Just close down the bases.
Yeah,
everything happening is already illegal.
Exactly. If you want to put your faith in the U.S. Congress, maybe you should go to church more often. David, there will be a point where this conflict comes to an end, and hopefully sooner than later. But I thought the Americans already won. How do you negotiate when you won? See, this is the trap that you put yourself into over and over again, David.
Well, how do you negotiate when you attack during the negotiations? How do you negotiate when no one can believe a word you say and you don't know what you think yourself because you're completely out of your mind? But the silver lining here is that some of these so-called host countries might be willing to have these bases leave their countries. They understand that these are not protection and deterrence, but are painting a target on your back. As Kissinger said, to be an enemy of the United States is dangerous, but be a friend is lethal. And if countries start to understand that hosting a U.S. base is very, very disadvantageous, not just economically, not just because of the drunks and the accidents and the lawless destruction and the mini apartheid states in their midst, but because it's a target on their back. And people start looking to the example of Spain, in particular, Azerbaijan, other places that have said no. Why would Spain say you can't use your bases in our country and then not say, and you have to leave because you can't use them next year? Well, because they're going to get a different government. But this ought to be the example that countries around the world are learning from, get the U.S. bases out if you don't want a U.S. war in your country.
Yes, indeed. And unfortunately, we're running out of time. But, Michael and I were speaking before the program. Another level of what, how this is developing is the end of NATO, which, of course, will be a topic of another program. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Charlottesville, Reston, and in Beirut. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.